Welcome to life on Earth. Welcome to life on Earth. Welcome to life on Earth.
Howard Rourke laughed. He stood naked at the edge of a cliff. The lake lay far below him. A frozen explosion of granite burst in flight to the sky over the motionless water. The water seemed immovable, the stone flowing. The stone had the stillness of one brief moment in battle when thrust meets thrust and the currents are held in a pause more dynamic than motion. The stone glowed, wet with sun rays. The lake below was only a thin steel ring that cut the rocks in half. The rocks went down into the depth unchanged. They began and ended in the sky so that the world seemed suspended in space, an island floating on nothing, anchored to the feet of the man on the cliff. Today is Thursday, June 29th, 2023. Welcome to Life on Earth. In the Romantic Manifesto, in her essay, The Goal of My Writing, Ayn Rand wrote, quote, "Although the representation of things as they might be and ought to be helps man to achieve things in real life, this is only a secondary value. The primary value is that it gives him the experience of living in a world where things are as they ought to be. This experience is of crucial importance to him. It is his psychological lifeline. Since man's ambition is unlimited, since his pursuit and achievement of values is a lifelong process, and the higher the values, the harder the struggle, man needs a moment, an hour, or some period of time in which he can experience the sense of his completed task, the sense of living in a universe where his values have been successfully achieved. It's like a moment of rest, a moment to gain fuel, to move further. Art gives him that fuel. Art gives him the experience of seeing the full, immediate, concrete reality of his distant goals. The importance of that experience is not what he learns from it, but in that he experiences it. And the fuel is not a theoretical principle, not a didactic message, but the life-giving fact of experiencing a moment of metaphysical joy, a moment of love for existence." Close quote. Now, I used to wonder about this. If the primary purpose of art is the experience of the art itself, well, isn't that also a means to an end? Isn't that inspiration, that affirmation, that rejuvenation, you know, in Ayn Rand's words, that spiritual fuel, isn't that a means to an end then? Think gasoline, for example, fuel. Fuel isn't an end in itself. So why is it that spiritual fuel is an end in itself? But you see, my metaphor of gasoline to fuel, it doesn't hold in this regard. What I needed to fully understand and accept and integrate was this. Life is an end in itself. It is necessarily an end in itself. The fact of valuing, the experience of experiencing values, of experiencing any person, any object, any sensation, any artwork as a value. This is a wholly individual thing. Pleasure, joy, happiness is only a state of a living organism, a person, you and me. The spiritual value of art is an end in itself because the individual experiencing the artwork is an end in himself or herself. Your life is an end in itself. Let me continue a bit from The Goal of My Writing by Ayn Rand. She writes this. A given individual may choose to move forward to translate that meaning of that experience into the actual course of his life. Or he may fail to live up to it and spend the rest of his life betraying it. But whatever the case may be, the artwork remains intact, an entity complete in itself, an achieved, realized, immovable fact of reality, like a beacon raised over the dark crossroads of the world, saying, this is possible. No matter what its consequences, that experience is not a way station that one passes, but a stop, a value in itself. It is an experience about which one can say, I am glad to have reached to this in my life. There are not many experiences of that kind to be found in the modern world. And then she goes on a bit later. There is a scene in The Fountainhead, which is a direct expression of this issue. I was, again, Ayn Rand talking about writing, I was, in a sense, both characters in that scene, but it was written primarily from the aspect of myself as the consumer rather than the producer of art. It was based on my own desperate longing for the sight of human achievement. I regarded the emotional meaning of that scene as entirely personal, almost subjective, and I did not expect it to be shared by anyone. But that scene proved to be the one most widely understood and most frequently mentioned by the readers of The Fountainhead. It is the opening scene of part four between Howard Rourke and the boy on the bicycle. Unquote. Again, Ayn Rand from The Goal of My Writing. Now, minor spoiler alert. If you haven't yet read The Fountainhead, this passage and this discussion will be a little bit spoilery. Minor, but it's there. Also, I might have to pause if my emotions demand it. The Fountainhead, Part 4, Chapter 1. The leaves streamed down, trembling in the sun. They were not green, only a few scattered through the torrent stood out in single drops of a green so bright and pure that it hurt the eyes. The rest were not a color, but a light, the substance of fire on metal, living sparks without edges, and it looked as if the forest were a spread of light boiling slowly to produce this color, this green rising in small bubbles, the condensed essence of spring. The trees met, bending over the road, and the spots of sun on the ground moved with the shifting of the branches like a conscious caress. The young man hoped he would not have to die. Not if the earth could look like this, he thought. Not if he could hear the hope and the promise, like a voice, with leaves, tree trunks, and rocks instead of words. But he knew that the earth looked like this only because he had seen no sign of men for hours. He was alone, riding his bicycle down a forgotten trail through the hills of Pennsylvania, where he had never been before, where he could feel the fresh wonder of an untouched world. He was a very young man. He had just graduated from college in this spring of the year 1935, and he wanted to decide whether life was worth living. Now, he did not know that this was the question in his mind. He did not think of dying. He thought only that he wished to find joy and reason and meaning in life, and that none had been offered to him anywhere. He had not liked the things taught to him in college. He had been taught a great deal about social responsibility, about a life of service and self-sacrifice. Everyone had said that it was beautiful and inspiring. Only he had not felt inspired. He had felt nothing at all. He could not name the thing he wanted of life. He felt it here, in this wild loneliness. But he did not face nature with the joy of a healthy animal as a proper and final setting. He faced it with the joy of a healthy man, as a challenge, as tools, means, and material. So he felt anger that he should find exaltation only in the wilderness, that this great sense of hope had to be lost when he would return to men and men's work. He thought that this was not right, that man's work should be a higher step, an improvement on nature, not a degradation. He did not want to despise men. He wanted to love and admire them. But he dreaded the sight of the first house, pool room, and movie poster he would encounter on his way. He had always wanted to write music, and he could give no other identity to the thing he sought. Well, if you want to know what it is, he told himself, listen to the first phrases of Tchaikovsky's first concerto, or the last movement of Rachmaninoff's second. Men have not found the words for it, nor the deed, nor the thought, but they have found the music. Let me see that in one single act of man on earth. Let me see it made real. Let me see the answer to the promise of that music. Not servants, nor those served, not altars or immolations, but the final, the fulfilled, innocent of pain. Don't help me or serve me, but let me see it once, because I need it. Don't work for my happiness, my brothers. Show me yours. Show me that it is possible. Show me your achievement, and the knowledge will give me courage for mine. He saw a blue hole ahead where the road ended on the crest of a ridge. The blue looked cool and clean, like a film of water stretched in the frame of green branches. It would be funny, he thought, if I came to the edge and found nothing but that blue beyond, nothing but the sky ahead, above and below. He closed his eyes and went on, suspending the possible for a moment, granting himself a dream, a few instants of believing that he would reach the crest, open his eyes, and see the blue radiance of the sky below. His foot touched the ground, breaking his motion. He stopped and opened his eyes. He stood still. In the broad valley, far below him, in the first sunlight of early morning, he saw a town. Only it was not a town. Towns did not look like that. He had to suspend the possible for a while longer, to seek no questions or explanations, only to look. There were small houses on the ledges of the hill before him, flowing down to the bottom. He knew that the ledges had not been touched, that no artifice had altered the unplanned beauty of the graded steps. Yet some power had known how to build on those ledges in such a way that the houses became inevitable, and one could no longer imagine the hills as beautiful without them. As if the centuries and the series of chances that produced these ledges in the struggle of great blind forces had waited for their final expression, had only been a road to a goal, and the goal was these buildings, part of the hills, shaped by the hills, yet ruling them by giving them meaning. The houses were plain fieldstone, like the rocks jutting from the green hillsides, and of glass, great sheets of glass, used as if the sun were invited to complete the structures, sunlight becoming part of the masonry. There were many houses. They were small, they were cut off from one another, and no two of them were alike, but they were like variations on a single theme, like a symphony played by an inexhaustible imagination. And one could still hear the laughter of the force that had been let loose on them, as if that force had run, unrestrained, challenging itself to be spent, but never reaching its end. Music, he thought. The promise of the music he had invoked, the sense of it made real. There it was, before his eyes. He did not see it. He heard it in chords. He thought that there was a common language of thought, sight, and sound. Was it mathematics? The discipline of reason. Music was mathematics. And architecture was music and stone. And he knew he was dizzy because this place below him could not be real. He saw trees, lawns, walks twisting up the hillsides, steps cut in the stone. He saw fountains, swimming pools, tennis courts, and not a sign of life. The place was uninhabited. It did not shock him, not as the sight of it had shocked him. In a way, it seemed proper. This was not part of known existence. For the moment, he had no desire to know what it was. After a long time, he glanced about him, and then he saw that he was not alone. Some steps away from him, a man sat on a boulder, looking down at the valley. The man seemed absorbed in the sight and had not heard his approach. The man was tall and gaunt and had orange hair. He walked straight to the man, who turned his eyes to him. The eyes were gray and calm. The boy knew suddenly that they felt the same thing, and he could speak as he would not speak to a stranger anywhere else. "That isn't real, is it?" the boy asked, pointing down. "Why, yes, it is now," the man answered. "Well, it's not a movie set or a trick of some kind?" "No, it's a summer resort. It's just been completed. It will be open in a few weeks." "Who built it?"
"I did."
What's your name?"
"Howard Rourke."
"Thank you," said the boy. He knew that the steady eyes looking at him understood everything those two words had to cover. Howard Rourke inclined his head in acknowledgement. Wheeling his bicycle by his side, the boy took the narrow path down the slope of the hill to the valley and the houses below. Rourke looked after him. He had never seen that boy before, and he would never see him again. He did not know that he had given someone the courage to face a lifetime. Now, Ayn Rand gives us the courage, the motivation, and the inspiration, and the moral certainty to face a lifetime. So let me read briefly from Anthem, Anthem by Ayn Rand, chapter 11. "I am, I think, I will. My hands, my spirit, my sky, my forest, this earth of mine. What must I say besides? These are the words. This is the answer. I stand here on the summit of the mountain. I lift my head and I spread my arms. This, my body and spirit, this is the end of the quest. I wished to know the meaning of things. I am the meaning. I wished to find a warrant for being. I need no warrant for being and no word of sanction upon my being. I am the warrant and the sanction." I intended to include some passages from Atlas Shrugged, but I want to keep this brief. So just a few quotes. But first, let me say thank you to Bonnie for the super chat. I do appreciate that. Thank you. I've been ignoring or just haven't been keeping up with the chat. But thank you. Thank you for your comments. I do appreciate that. And maybe I should explain, but most folks know that you get a short show today. OCon is coming up. I'm traveling tomorrow. And this is what I wanted to share before I go. I'll have a few more things to say about it. Jeff Bannister is in with a super chat as well. Thank you very much for that. You are amazing too. And Jamie Hernandez is in as well. Thank you as well. Very much appreciated. Your super chats make your comments stand out, and you certainly deserve for your comments to stand out. And you know they support the Ayn Rand Center UK, this channel that makes so much possible, so much content out there. In fact, I'll talk about that a bit before we go, but your super chats, your contributions, your membership in the Ayn Rand Center UK, your YouTube membership on channel, y'all make it possible. Shout out to our sponsors who do too. In fact, we'll talk about that in a bit too. Again, just a few quotes from Atlas Shrugged, because I read The Fountainhead and the political message is crucial. When Ayn Rand says, it had to be said, the world is perishing from an orgy of self-sacrifice. There is an ethics, there is a politics to that novel. But the aesthetics and the metaphysics, well, somebody mentioned just before the show, Boy and the Bicycle, I don't know that I know that. I thought, oh, then it needs to be said again. Think of the quotes from Atlas Shrugged. We never had to take any of it seriously, did we? No, we never had to. The man who says, no, we never had to, is taking it all more seriously than anybody else in the book. The man who says, no, we never had to, is risking everything to save the world and the people he loves. When he says, no, we never had to, what he means is we never had to take it as metaphysical. We never had to take it as essential. We never had to take it as the meaning of life, the evil, the threats. Another quote from that book, never think of pain or danger or enemies a moment longer than is necessary to fight them. From The Big Speech, the achievement of your happiness is the only moral purpose of your life. And that happiness, not pain or mindless self-indulgence, is the proof of your moral integrity, since it is the proof and the result of your loyalty to the achievement of your values. And closer to the end of that speech, in the name of the best within you, do not sacrifice this world to those who are its worst. In the name of the values that keep you alive, do not let your vision of man be distorted by the ugly, the cowardly, the mindless in those who have never achieved his title. Do not lose your knowledge that man's proper estate is an upright posture, an intransigent mind with a step that travels unlimited roads. Do not let your fire go out, spark by irreplaceable spark, in the hopeless swamps of the approximate, the not quite, the not yet, the not at all. Do not let the hero in your soul perish in lonely frustration for the life you deserved but have never been able to reach. Check your road and the nature of your battle. The world you desired can be won. It exists. It is real. It is possible. It's yours. Now, tomorrow, I will board an airplane and I will fly miles above the ground at over 500 miles an hour to Miami, where Amy and I will attend, I'm sure, very well-crafted presentations, and we will go out for finely prepared meals. And we're going to see skilled flamenco dancers and tour the magnificently developed Florida coast on a luxury boat and spend a week with just some of the best people in the world and watch fireworks to celebrate the heroes who founded this magnificent country on Independence Day. And yesterday on the Daily Objective, OCON presenter Nicholas Krusek hosted Linda Cordair of ARC UK sponsor Quent Cordair Fine Art. And I wrote something in the super chat that I will repeat. But first, again, thank you. Thank you for the super chats. Shout out to Rhett and shout out to Apollo Zeus, who are both in. Rhett says, this show gives me the courage to face a lifetime. Well, I hope so. because this show is, you know, 98% me reading Ayn Rand. This particular episode is unusual in that way, and I'm glad it's giving you exactly what I personally wanted to get out of it too. Apollo Zeus says, thank you, Robert. This is very inspiring. Again, thank you. I don't take the credit, but I do appreciate that. Again, yesterday on TDO, The Daily Objective, Ayn Rand Center, UK's 1 o'clock in the afternoon Eastern, 6 o'clock in the evening, daily show. Linda Cordair was on with Nicholas Krusak, and I wrote in the Super Chat, and I used the Super Chat because I put my dollars in too. I'm not just an ARC UK host, I'm a Super Chat supporter too. And I wrote, the Cordair Collection, Cordair.com, C-O-R-D-A-I-R.com. The Cordair Collection inspires me in so many ways, not least of which is that it includes both very special, talented, objectivist artists, but also artists from the wider creative world. And for me, this for me is analogous to to objectivists, to Ayn Rand admirers. This is analogous to our place in the wider world. We are surrounded by miracles, by which I mean the products of a broad range of good, virtuous, magnificent, creative people. Now, most of us have been all too familiar with that feeling that the world's getting worse. Science and technology is barely holding on, while art and philosophy are long gone. But we have all been very fortunate. Blessed, if I can use that word in an earthly way, and I can, to discover the artistic works and the philosophical work of Ayn Rand, as well as the broad array, however much it might seem like the exception in modern times, of magnificent art, of sculpture, of painting, of music, of dance. There's a little Monadnock Valley in every achievement. And in the motive, the desire to create, to produce, to achieve, to be able and virtuous and proud and happy to live a life worth living. There's a Monadnock in the palm of my hand every time I pick up my smartphone, which itself is a work of art. And I use this device to connect to a world of kindred spirits. Now, I hope that none of you are feeling like our friend on the bicycle, that you hope you don't have to die for lack of spiritual fuel. But I do know the feeling. I've been there. And fortunately, I have seen the Monadnock Valley that Howard Roark, that Ayn Rand has built. And so, like our friend on the bicycle, I too say, thank you to Rand and to all of the better artists and innovators and creators and producers and kindred spirits, including all of you. In that regard, I am the boy on the bicycle. I hope you are too.